Hello and welcome to the Players Podcast presented by In the Money Media. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatale, back with you in the area affectionately known as the Degenerate Flophouse, adjacent to the Little House on the East Side in Saratoga. Got a fun show for you today. We're going to be going in a little bit different direction than we often do on this show. We're going to start out with a guest I've been waiting to have back on the show from Woodbine. We'll have their CEO, Jim Lawson, to talk about this exciting time in their calendar and some of the challenges 2020 has faced up there, but also some great racing and some good results they've been getting north of the border. And then we've also got our friend Kim Weir from the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, not just talking about TRF initiatives today, but talking about how she spent her summer, which was as a hot walker in the backside of Saratoga. So some interesting stories there. I think you're going to really enjoy it. Stick around and we'll be up right away with our first guest. And now I'd like to bring in a man who you know as the CEO of Woodbine Entertainment, Jim Lawson. Welcome back to the Players Podcast.
Great. Nice to be on again. Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
I figure this was a perfect time to touch base with you on the heels of a huge weekend at Woodbine last weekend with a lot to look forward to coming up this coming weekend. But I figured I'd start out with the basic question. You're one of the few people who got to be there for what was a memorable, if extremely unique, edition of the Queen's Plate. What was it like at Woodbine last Saturday?
In a word, very different than what we're used to, or in a word, different. But it was great. It was certainly a strange feeling going in. It's usually a festival type atmosphere with bands, stages set up, and just throngs of people in fashion shows and food trucks, and it's just very different. But we did manage to bring in the connections of the horses and the Queen's Plate and some of our customers. And it was a small, intimate gathering, but the atmosphere was nice and still exciting. And, hats off to our Woodbine management team because they really made an effort to make it a special day. And I think they did. It was a good experience.
What were you expecting in terms of results, in terms of betting handle, and how did reality meet those expectations?
Well, it's really, really hard to anticipate in this environment. I think we've been wagering strong, so I expected us to have a good day, and we were in total around 15 million. Our earliest published results were at 14.5 million, but that did not include a couple of foreign separate pools that reported the day after. So we were at 15 million. Our record handle for the day is 18 million. So all things considered, very good. And it, as I said, it's hard to anticipate. We had about 1.5 million on track last year, and it's hard to determine how much of that you lose, but I would assume we lost most of it. And the experience, as you know, when the Derby was pretty similar this year too. I don't think they had the day they anticipated, and then our numbers are obviously a lot smaller, but we did miss that on track handle, and a number of people who probably would bet on a big day like that, who would only bet on that day, they either don't download or don't get on online, and it just makes it more difficult because we were also missing a lot of bricks and mortar wagering that we've had historically at our off track wagering. So all in all, we were happy with the day.
I was impressed not just on the day, honestly, but the days surrounding it. I feel like Woodbine has been a track that there've been a lot of new eyes on and people paying attention to throughout this season. And I imagine that momentum is going to continue. What are your expectations for what we're going to see next weekend at Woodbine?
I think we'll have a good, a good day both Saturday and Sunday this coming weekend. I mean, interesting toss-up when you look at, would you rather have competition or not have competition? And we had Kentucky Downs last Saturday. This week we'll have Belmont. Unfortunately, and is they're not going to be racing at Santa Anita this weekend, and it's hard to know what impact that will have. But I think that we should have good days both days. I mean, Belmont. I don't know what their card looks like or is going to look like for Saturday, but we work cooperatively with the NYRA group, and that should help us. I wish, Peter, that this went on in racing more, that tracks seem to run on top of each other, and we don't have that problem with NYRA. They're good and cooperative, so I think we'll have a good day on Saturday working with NYRA, with the Belmont card on, and then at the end of the day, we might have the benefit of Santa Anita not running in terms of handle, but we have a good card coming up. I mean, the race should be the Woodbine Mile will be small but competitive, and we should talk about that. And I think the Singspiel, which is running that day at a mile and a quarter on the turf, that's shaping up to be a full field. So I'm looking forward to Saturday and Sunday with the two winning year in races, the Natelma and the Summer Stakes, the 2 year old races. I think we'll have all eyes on those races and should have a good day Sunday too.
We're going to be covering from wall to wall on the network. We got a lot of stuff coming up, some full card coverage. It'll be out Thursday, and then a lot of individual videos previewing the big races. Personally, I'm really excited for some of the storylines in this year's Woodbine Mile. This has been the target for a long time for War of Will, looking to make his triumphant return up to Woodbine. I was also interested to see listed among the entries a very intriguing young prospect, and Cheryl Spite going to be apparently joining the starting gate. I would imagine that there's a lot of anticipation for this year's running.
Yeah, there sure is. I mean, Cheryl Spite, such an interesting horse. I mean, there was he's getting notice as a young phenom, and there was talk he got pulled out of the Derby, and there was talk that he might step into the Derby and provide some competition when it looked like Tis the Law was they were going to hand it to Tis the Law at one point. That's why you run the races, but. I think Roger Atfield was looking at the Preakness and decided to stay home for this race, which is great for us. And of course, our horse of the year in Canada, Starship Jubilee, it looks like she's going to be in there too. So I think it's going to be a competitive field. Mark Cassie's got March to the Arch, who is a nice horse too, so I think there are in terms of stories coming up to this race. So you've got March to the Arch and War of Will out of Mark's barn, and I think he's putting another horse of Gary Barber's in there, Olympic Runner, and then Cheryl Spite and Starship Jubilee. We'll have a small field. I don't know whether we'll have seven or eight, but it's certainly. It certainly will have a lot of intrigue with the three-year-old in there and War of Will and Starship Jubilee. So I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
I can't wait. I'm only sad this will be the first one in about 5 years I haven't been able to make my way up for, but obviously this year being what it is, no real surprise there. In terms of having spectators back, how often are you looking at and reevaluating the opportunity to do more in terms of being able to include owners/fans at the facility? Or have you made any decisions for the rest of the year going forward?
Yeah, well, I would say we're looking at it every day. I mean, we're sensitive and conscious of the desires of our wagering customers and our owners, both of whom are very important to what we do. The difference in Ontario is we've had very tight restrictions, government restrictions, a maximum of 100 people outside and 50 people outside. I think that's an or rather than an and. we had to, on Queen's Plate Day, go to the health authorities and present them with a detailed plan, which they finally approved, not that far in advance, quite frankly. And we're still living under those restrictions today. As we see COVID this week in Ontario, it's starting, unfortunately, to creep back up from an average of 100 new cases a day. I think we're closer to in the mid 200s now, and there's a fear like is going on everywhere that with the cooler weather coming on and people moving inside, that this COVID could creep up. So we're planning that the government restrictions which we're living under are not going to change, and accordingly we're just hoping on that note that we can continue to bring in the owners and some people in every day to a maximum of 100 people outside. And it's difficult, but the online product that we have is good, and we just hope we get through the rest of the year and everyone gets through it safely in terms of racing, because that's the key consideration, is to let our horse people move ahead and race, and let's hope we're as successful as we have been so far.
I agree. It's one of those things where, of course, it's a bummer to have an event like the Breeders' Cup and not be able to have fans at it, but it's just, this is a time to let discretion be the better part of valor, in my opinion. We're still in the midst of a fight against this, you know, incredible enemy, and the fact that we've been able to have racing all this time, I mean, I would definitely have as one of my priorities, if I were an executive in your shoes or at the Breeders' Cup, the idea that, you know, at least we've had racing this whole time, and let's not do anything to imperil that. As great as it is to go to these events live, the fact that they can still exist and be beamed to the world as a television or internet product, I mean, for me, that's really been worth a lot ever since the early days of the pandemic, all the way through these rescheduled events like the Kentucky Derby and the Queen's Plate. And I assume that's your perspective as well.
Yes, that's a great point, Peter. Absolutely, that's paramount. When you step back and you say, let's not let our guard down, let's not take any risks. If we do, what we risk here is putting the whole sport under, and we just can't do that. And so while it would be nice, we've marched to within the government restrictions, and we've kept this going. And it's been great for us to keep it going. It's been great for all the horse interest to keep it going. And I think it would the idea of continuing racing all through this fall is paramount. And we're not in a position to take any risks to jeopardize that. And let's hope the industry and all the participants feel the same way. And I can say that the cooperation we've got from our horse people has been tremendous, and it's been a big key to our success to effectively being COVID-free in our backstretch for 6 months now.
How did your day, just your personal day on Queen's Plate this year, differ from what you do in a typical year?
For your viewing audience, we're somewhere between the Kentucky Derby and Royal Ascot in terms of the pomp and pageantry. We have a representative of the Queen always. This year it was the Lieutenant Governor who did show up, but usually the Lieutenant Governor shows up with a Royal Landau and a horse parade and the RCMP, and there's a lot of pomp and ceremony around that, and that was completely eliminated this year. The Lieutenant Governor arrived in a car and arrived in a boardroom, and while we did watch the race from a royal box, it just much of my official duties disappeared, and had a little more time, not necessarily to wager, but just to focus on the racing. And I remember leaving the paddock with the Lieutenant Governor, and I looked at her and I said, boy, it's really strange that I know almost everyone here this year, whereas in other years there's 30 or 35,000 people in attendance. So it was very different, and I look forward to when we can have a big we use our special days to try and be successful in building it into that. And it was sure disappointing that we spent a lot of time working on a Queen's Plate at home experience and working with CTV and across Canada, having a digital experience at home, and it worked well. And so hopefully we'll return to the big crowds next year and possibly the year after, depending on, we might have to wait. None of us know where this is going, obviously, and that's the hard part. But.
Did the Queen send her regards? I know she's attended the event many times.
As a tradition, we certainly send a telegram to the Queen right after the race, and it doesn't take long for Buckingham Palace to send the 50 guineas on to us in a banknote rather than 50 guineas, which we will forward on to the winning owner. So the winning prize is the 60% of the $1 million purse plus 50 guineas from Buckingham Palace. So we still do that. And after the race, we have a ceremony, which again, we did this year, where I read out the telegram that we then sent on to Her Majesty late Saturday afternoon.
That's fantastic stuff. I wanted to ask you about a couple of other things a bit further afield. One was following you on Twitter. I've become available. I've become informed about the Trust 15 charity. I wanted to give the listeners a chance to learn a little bit more about that cause, which I know means a lot to you.
Well, yeah, thanks. Thanks for letting me mention that. It is a youth organization that was started by a woman named Marcia Brown about 8 or 9 years ago, and she was a school counselor. And it's really a case in a local neighborhood close to Woodbine, the Rexdale neighborhood, where in her role, Marcia was seeing so much pressure on young men and young women at the high school level to pursue, not necessarily by their own choice, I guess peer pressure would be a more appropriate term than pursue, but pursue down a path or go down the path of a gang lifestyle and drug lifestyle. And a lot of these people, young men and women, have unfortunate home situations. And what was started was a youth support organization and building built by giving these people some help and support outside their home and at school with leadership from local business. Built into an organization with hundreds of youth participants at all levels now, not only through high school, but through elementary school, of people to give these young students and an opportunity and to give them hope, an opportunity to meet people in the community who are business leaders in all different facets of, when I say business, the arts and music and sports and to give these people hope. And there's a big alumni element to it, where people who have been in this program are now coming back to support the program. And we're very proud of Woodbine Entertainment's involvement in it. I'm the current chairman of the organization, and they do great work, and I appreciate you letting me speak about it. Yeah, it's Trust 15, and they have Trust 15 official. I think they're on Facebook, and Twitter, and led by a woman named Marcia Brown, who's very active in the community. And they do such great work. It's really heartwarming to see the way people pitch in and help out with these young youth, and it just changes people's lives, which is what it's all about. People, as I say, these young people come out of very troubled home environments and a difficult community, and in this day and age where we're so supportive to make sure that there's equal opportunity for these young people, and they get their support. It's certainly been a rallying point, not only for Woodbine Entertainment and our employees, but throughout the community. The Trust 15 organization is getting a lot of making an impact in changing these people's lives. So it's been great.
I will tag them in the social posts for this show, and if folks want to check out more information, that'll be a good way to do just that. While I have you, if you have another minute, I wanted to talk to you about your background in the sport of racing specifically, because I knew you were involved on the breeding side of things, but I had a lot of fun talking to you last time. Unfortunately, I'd already turned the microphone off. I wish I'd just kept it rolling. We could have posted the whole thing, but I wanted you to start at the beginning of your relationship to horse racing. How did you get involved in the first place, and what really was the lure, especially of the breeding side of the business?
Thanks. I think it's important that racing executives understand racing and breeding, and I think anyone who's involved in the sport of horse racing, whether it's as a wagering person, as an owner, or working at the racetrack, or working at a farm, I think we all begin to understand how difficult this industry is in terms of when I say to people, boy, if you could get to Woodbine and just win one race, you do pretty well in terms of what it looks like for your economics for the year. Then they say, well, that sounds pretty easy. And I said, no, it's not easy to win one race. It's important for racing executives, and I don't think there's enough of it, and I'm not focusing or trying to be critical of anyone, but I think I have always felt like it's important and an added plus that I grew up in the industry. My father was a breeder and racer of racehorses. He's in the Canadian Horse Racing Hall of Fame. He ran a small and humble stable, but he was a very astute person when it came to breeding horses and racing horses. He did his homework, and so it's been fun. It's been a lifetime passion of mine. I spent my youth going to either what was then the Thoroughbred Record or the Blood Horse, and going through every catalog with my father and reporting the results so he could learn about more about breeding. And I won't call it a misspent youth, because here I am today. I've always loved the breeding end of the game. But what that shows you when you get into the breeding end of the game, it just shows you how difficult it is. Peter, I'm really digressing here. I had a horse in Classic Dipton sale this week, Liam's Map colt out of a Scat Daddy mare who broke her maiden at Saratoga, and he's a good-looking colt. And boy, I ended up having to buy him back, and I'm just shaking my head saying, man, this is tough. If a colt like that doesn't sell, this is a tough game. And you just, in addition to all the, you know, the problems people have with colic and horses with crooked legs, and you know the story if you've ever been involved in breeding. But part of the fun for me is looking at the new sires every year and doing the genealogy and figuring out what the right mixes are for breeding, and I've had a lot of fun with it, and it just makes the racing game so much more interesting. And as an executive at a racetrack, you certainly understand the challenges that the breeders and the owners go through to get where they are. And you can give them a lot of empathy and support as you understand what they've been through to get where they are.
You say you've had a lot of fun with it, but I know you've also had a lot of success. And part of that has been identifying some of these sires before they become mega sires, without, you know, asking you to give away all your knowledge. What do you feel is the key to identifying these sires who are going to become the next big thing before everybody else realizes it? I think horse players can use that information in their betting, as well as breeders obviously using it when they're picking their matings.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I won't say I suggest that I have any formula, but certainly I'm not in a position that I can afford the very top sire. So my my approach has historically been to get in early and get in with a preference for horses that are precocious and have had some speed. So, you know, I had the opportunity to breed to Scat Daddy right off the bat and Into Mischief early on. I bred to Mattoli this year. Liam's Map's another one, although as I said, I didn't do that great last week with Liam's Map. He's not the flavor of the month right now, but maybe he will be again. So I from a breeding standpoint, I like to breed for speed. And when I say speed, that 7-furlong mile horse, a lot of them as you've seen, have been so successful. I bred to Cantharos this year. I think he's good value for the money. You just never know who's going to turn out. It's really hard to predict, but if you need to live within a budget, I would say that for me, getting them early and have a leaning towards those horses that excelled at a mile has been a formula that's worked.
How focused are you on the physicality of the sires as opposed to the kind of stuff you grew up looking at in the record and the blood horse? It seems like there's a divide, with some people being a little more focused on physicality, some people being a little more focused on the pedigree itself and the page. Where do you fall in that continuum?
I think the physicality is important, no question. But sometimes other than size, I try, and certainly I would not send a small mare to a small sire. But other than size, you don't know much until they've had a couple of crops on the ground. And some horses have a propensity to, and you hear this all the time, propensity to have foals that do not come out straight legged. And that sometimes is hard to anticipate. I know, for example, you know, the Unbridled Songs for years always had a reputation for not being the best looking individual's physicality. So certainly people pay attention to that at some point, and often you don't know that. Some horses that, I think, for example, Awesome Again, Ghost Sapper. I think there was a difference there in terms of the quality of the individuals, how they looked, and often these sires produce big foals, so I pay attention to the extent of the size of my mare, and ultimately the reputation. If I'm selling for commercial purposes, you certainly don't want to breed to a horse that has a reputation for throwing well-conformed foals, and you do learn that 2 or 3 years in.
No doubt about it. What are your current plans for the Liam's Map? Is this one you'd consider racing yourself?
Yeah, interesting. I used Warndale sales, and a couple of people came back and tried to buy the horse privately in his. This yearling colt's half sister, who's an Animal Kingdom, she worked in 46-4 on a pretty slow dirt training track at Woodbine on Saturday. This is her third black letter workout in a row. So I called Kitty Taylor at Warndale after that workout on Saturday. I said, I think we better take a breather on selling that horse privately. The half sister worked in 46-4 this morning and blew away its workmate. And I think we'll just take a rest for a bit. And we may still put him in a 2-year-old in training sale. But I, in light of the way the sister has trained now 3 black letter workouts in a row, I better take a pause and do the right thing and see how she turns out, because it looks like she's a nice horse, but of course you never know, and a lot of them are morning glories, but she appears to be the real deal, and we'll see. So I'm hopeful.
I'm glad to get you to open up a little bit about some of the stuff on the breeding side. I didn't want to let you get out of here without a chance to speak directly to the bettors who make up so much of our audience. I know we've talked in the past about how you view the bettors as one of the pillars of racing, obviously. But I was curious, in your own experience, how important wagering on horses has been for you.
I like to wager. Now we can talk about misspent youth. I've been wagering at Woodbine probably for many more years than I was legally allowed to wager. Then in thinking of misspent youth, I played professional hockey for 3 years. And what did I do in the summers? I headed to the racetrack and Eddie Olchek, I guess. But what else do you do in the off season? You gotta fight. So I love handicapping. I think, and your customers will understand this. I'm a much better handicapper than I am wager. I can figure the races out, but do reasonably well. But in terms of betting them properly, I mean, all of us can relate to the fact that we love a horse and we use it in exotics, and we end up losing money on the race because we did the exotics the wrong way. And I'm learning after doing this for 50 years that maybe I should just be doing win in place wagering and quit trying to take my horse in the exotics. We all have stories of that, but there's a special art to wagering, right? And you know that it's a different skill set than how to wager properly. But I love the challenge, and it's the best. I mean, I really think people who are involved in racing and wagering, it's a passion, and it's a passion for me. These are special animals, and it's a lot of fun to try and figure it out. And you can figure it out that the next step is trying to put that ticket in properly, which is not easy to do always, even if you think you know the right horse.
No doubt. No, we hear that all the time. That's probably our most frequently asked question. And one of our goals on the network going forward is to do more content geared towards the wagering side of things. Because I think a lot of the sound you heard there was a lot of listeners nodding their heads in agreement as you were speaking. Jim, thank you so much. Congratulations on a great weekend last weekend. We look forward to more success from Woodbine as the season goes on, and really appreciate your time today and look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Great. Enjoy speaking with you. Thanks, and all the best to everyone. Take care. Thank you.
And now I'm very excited to welcome back to the show. I'm going to do it again. I love this little appellation for this next guest, the First Lady of the In the Money Players Podcast from the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. It's Kim Weir. Kim, how are you?
I am just great, Pete. I laugh every time, and I look around Laura every time you introduce me that way. Sadly, I'm a little more often in a very sweaty baseball cap than a tiara these days, but nonetheless, I will take it. I will take it.
A few things I want to talk to you about. First of all is this fun latest promotion we've come up with between the podcast and the TRF, the In the Money Players Podcast whiskey, the 6-year-old malt whiskey that I picked out down at the Albany Distilling Company. We just put it on sale officially via our newsletter in late last week. And only a handful of bottles. If folks want to get in on this, they should act fast. But I was curious, have we had any orders so far? And tell people where they can make their donation, so I will then send them their free bottle.
Well, that is such a fun combination of things that many of us, certainly you and I, enjoy. You know, horses and horse racing and TRF and bourbon and whiskey, just like such an awesome combination. But it is, you, as soon as you posted or put it in your newsletter, the requests started coming in, and we are tickled pink to be the recipients of these generous donations, and love the concept of the thank you gift coming from In the Money with this beautiful bottle of bourbon. So the good news is that it is as easy as ever for your wonderful audience to give to us. And that is through our beloved link, the trfinc.org/players. It's right there with a great picture of you and your bottle and your glass. We're just delighted. And we loved meeting Rick from Albany Distilling Company and excited to have this, you know, creative collaboration. The team at the TRF, way beyond me, the creative part of the team at the TRF, just is marvels at these gifts coming in and how you and your audience are just making hay for the horses and bourbon for the people.
That's great. Well, this now technically it is, I can get where you're saying bourbon because the Albany Distilling Company do one. This is a malt whiskey. So this is a USA answer to Scotch. It is the way that it's aged. There are definitely some like bourbon notes and characteristics. I'm positioning it where whether you're if you're a Scotch drinker with an open mind to bourbon or a bourbon drinker with an open mind to Scotch, this whiskey is gonna hit you where you live. So we hope folks will take advantage of this. Like we said, we don't have we have a limited supply, but there are some bottles left, and we definitely want folks to get involved. I also wanted to talk to you about before we get to really the biggest headline in your world coming up of the show we're going to talk about in a bit. I want to talk to you about your summer experience, because I think a lot of horse players will be fascinated by this. Not that you didn't have enough to do already, but this extra job you took on this summer. It's just like the first day of school back in the day. Tell us what you did this summer.
Oh my gosh. Well, you are a kind to ask and kind to find it that you think that anybody would find it interesting. I sure found it interesting. So I did indeed embark upon like a personal growth adventure. I called it like the Knowles course for me at 50 years old to like learn and grow and be the new kid and throw myself into the position where you're the low man on the totem pole and you know nothing. Not that I ever really know much, but I definitely, I embarked upon it with all those things in mind. I said that I had three goals, which is I wanted to learn a lot, which I knew I would. I wanted to be helpful in any way that I could. And then I thought I would probably have some personal growth out of the whole thing because of the just throwing yourself out of your comfort zone. So yes, indeed, what I did, for those wondering what we're talking about, I signed on and was hired with gratitude for the offer to be a hot walker. Good, the ultimate in the walking of the hots, the thing that everyone from Cyndi Lauper to, you know, jazz musicians, you know, a lot of folks have walked those shed rows and among the first things I learned was this phrase. So this is a fun little like nugget for the audience, because I had never heard this phrase. And then everybody said these like three words to me: keep turning left. That is apparently what you tell someone when they get a job as a hot walker.
Very literal. Keep turning left.
Keep turning left. And so, of course, I think you and I could just ponder all the other ways in which we can use that phrase. But who knows? That's apparently a talisman. It's passed on from person to person. Dave Grenning said it to me when I took the job. I mean, everybody I know said, keep turning left. So, and indeed I did that. I took that advice.
That's good. You get in real trouble if you don't do that. Was it, what kind of a shock to the system was this gig? I mean, to go from a fairly standard hours of employment to, gee, you tell me, what time did you have to report to work for this job? What was the shift like as you were doing all this left turning over at the barn?
Yeah. Well, it was, in some ways, mine was a softer gig than many, but our hours, in fact, this is actually something that's somewhat standard. I was up at, set my alarm for 4:30 each morning. Also because I sort of am maybe it's my age. I love my morning routine, which has various pieces. And I decided to keep those routines, even though I would be doing them in the dark at 4:45 in the morning. So I'd get up at 4:30. I didn't have to be at the barn until 5:20. Fortunately for me, I mean, living right here in Saratoga, I'm a stone's throw from the track anyway, but the barn that I was working for was right on Nelson Avenue. So it was like a 2-minute drive. I did drive. Some folks have asked, like, did you walk? And then my dear husband, who's not really overly protective, or he wouldn't have let me do this.
Fair enough.
Yeah, clearly he's not that protective, but he did not want me walking Crescent in the dark at 5:00 in the morning. So I actually drove. They made it very easy. But
you were going to get your steps in, I have a feeling, as part of the job. So I think saving that energy might have proved key to your making it through the summer.
Yeah, that's probably not a bad observation. Yeah, it was interesting because there's actually a published schedule. I mean, these are like the beginning of the learning. Lord knows your audience will not want to have me hear the whole thing, but there's actually a fairly kind of published standard schedule. I'm not saying that all the barns adhere to it, but like 5 o'clock is when the grooms arrive and 5:30 is when the hot walkers arrive. That's like, you know, general standard operating procedure, I guess, because the track opens at 5:30. So you could kind of use the logic that the hot walker who's walking a horse, presumably after it's done something, doesn't need to be there until after a horse has done something. Sure. But that actually is immediately inaccurate. That's like in the spirit of all the things I learned, of which there were multitudinous, I learned that when you're a hot walker, you don't just walk hots. You also walk much less poetically named colds. That's not what they call them. They say you have a cold horse. So there's hot horses and there's cold horses. Incredibly logical, but just never really thought about it, which is true of almost everything I learned, is that you think you know how these things work. It's like everything in life. Until you do it, you really, really just don't know. So just for those curious, and you in particular, a cold horse is one that isn't going to work out that day, but needs to get out of his stall and move around. Often those horses are actually the ones running that afternoon, but they're also those that have done a little something, have a little tweak, have a little heat in their knee, whatever it may be. They can't exercise, so they need to get out. And I learned that those are the challenging ones.
It makes sense. A lot of energy to burn. I think of, yeah, you know, just in what little animal training I've done, when you can tire them, when they're tired, they're much more docile than when they're raring to go and can't, you know, do the thing that they want to do.
100% accurate. Yeah. So that was like, you know, an immediate learning is, you know, you sort of want to get the cold horses done first, because they're just going to be really difficult. Or, you know, you just don't know what you're going to get. You're just going to get a ball of energy is what you're going to get. So anyway, I walked both hot and colds and learned the difference along the way among so many things, but it was just an awesome experience. Just the amount of learning about the community that comes together to take care of these horses. And that was the greatest gift of the whole experience. And there were many of those too, was just feeling, even in this incredibly short period of time. It was about 5 weeks. I was, you know, a short timer, part timer, like the sweetest gig ever, really. This is the easy way to become a hot walker. I still felt that I had become a part of the community. I was the newbie. I was the gringa. I was totally the young one on the team. I mean, not young necessarily, although sometimes young. I just was welcomed. And the warmth of the welcome, considering how little I sort of brought to the table, was astonishing and really so rewarding to sort of feel like I was a part of the team, you know, the team that makes this sport happen. So I have a huge amount of respect for those who are doing this every day, 365, and there just are no breaks. We know that, but when I did my 4 and 5 day stints, I was really, really ready to have that next day happen when I got to go back to my life. And I'm profoundly grateful for that, but even more grateful for them, because they just keep going. The horses never stop and there's no breaks. There's no breaks for anybody back there.
Every day. It's unbelievable. How many miles were you walking a day?
Well, I did, of course, break out the Fitbit, you know, because you had to know. It was sort of like my own badge of honor. And so, it was an average of like 20 to 25,000 steps.
12 miles or so?
Yeah. And there was one day, which was like the first day I ever did the afternoons, which is one of my other favorite parts of this whole adventure, was the afternoon walks. There was one day I did 36,000 feet or steps.
That's like 18 miles. That's a lot.
It's especially when you think about that I was doing them in my duck boots. You know, I'm like, okay, so normally when you would do something like ambitious like that, you might wear like footwear appropriate for long distance. I love my duck boots. My duck boots, these are the same duck boots I believe that my mother and I purchased when I went to UVA in, let's just call it the late 80s, when I went to college. They were worn more in the 5 weeks of August 2020 than they've ever been worn cumulatively in the many decades that I've owned them.
Amazing. I got a bunch more questions for you on this. I hope you're not in a hurry. We're going to loop back to talk about the team that you were on at some point here, but let's talk about the afternoon work, because I know that was not always connected with the morning work in a way that I didn't quite understand before you were telling me about it.
Yeah, no, it was a complete eye-opener to me. And I do recognize, in fact, I was told regularly, like everything I was experiencing while it was a valid experience and representative of the life on the backstretch. It also was different because, heck, what isn't different in 2020? You know, everything's different this year. So folks would tell me, like, you're doing this year, but you should come back next year, because really, they'd said things like, because Saratoga is usually really fun. We all know that, but we had fun. You and I had a great time regardless. And so did I. But one of the things that I just don't know how much this opportunity would exist in a normal year is that the reason that they were so happy to see me is, frankly, that I had two hands, 2 feet, and would more or less follow instructions. And they were so short on staffing, which is why I thought I might be helpful. So the being short on staffing, it ties from the morning to the afternoon like this, in that you will have a barn with X number of horses, which will have the team, and the team consists of X number of riders, X number of grooms, and X number of hot walkers. Those are like the three pieces of the puzzle, basically. And so depending on how many horses you have, you know, you use your math to figure out how many of those you have. But then you look at the afternoon, and the afternoon involves a lot more walking, frankly, because wherever your barn is, you have to get from your barn to the holding barn. You have to be there a certain time before the race, and then you walk through, as we've all so enjoyed over the years, watching them walk through the backyard to the paddock. So there's just, the whole thing takes a heck of a lot longer than just a horse working out in the morning. And so you allocate one groom and one hot walker. And this year it was 100% totally limited to simply only one groom and one hot walker per horse, because they were limiting the number of people on the grounds. But you still have to have enough grooms and hot walkers to go with each horse for what ends up being kind of like an hour and a half-ish loop from paddock, you know, from your barn back to the paddock. And so anyway, this was a long way of saying they didn't have enough people, because they didn't have enough people to do anything, much less if you had, like, Linda Rice's barn was right near mine, and she would often have like 5 horses running in an afternoon. So that's 10 people. And considering she only had 5 horses up here, she didn't have 10 people. And that's where I guess I got to pinch hit. I was a freelance afternoon walker. Like, do you want to do afternoons, was the phrase that I started getting asked. Do you want to do afternoons? I was like, well, what does that mean? and it was so much fun, because it really did mean a lot of walking from my barn to the holding barn and then to the paddock. And then you get to watch the race. So I'm one of the few people, and I feel very lucky that I got to stand on the apron and watch quite a number of races with not a lot of other people, mostly other hot walkers and grooms. And,
what was that like? Pause on that for a second. That experience, I want to hear about.
Yeah, it was, well, like everything else, it was a bit weird, but it was also a bit just like always, because the view, looking at the horses running, that part is the one thing that looks normal. When you're standing on the apron, or if you were sitting in a seat or anywhere, you're looking at that beautiful infield, you're looking at the pond, you're looking at the NYRA flag and the US flag, and that part was surreally and wonderfully normal, because it just was as beautiful as ever. The sky just, we had such amazing weather this summer, and I'm sure you talked to your audience about that. And those who were here, we enjoyed it as best we could for everyone who wasn't. But that view, so the one part of the experience was that watching the horses run themselves, the scene with your eyeballs, was exactly as beautiful as ever. Nothing about that has been diminished. So let's just hold on to that. Like, that is the beautiful part. The, of course, totally unusual part is that there's no one cheering. Like, there just isn't. You hear the horses' hooves, which is also kind of cool, but not that we want it to continue like that. So not the people who were watching, which was, again, mostly grooms and hot walkers and a scattering of owners. They weren't cheering. None of us were cheering. I mean, you could, there's a little bit of clapping, but it was just no crowd noise. So that was strange, but it also was very intimate. And, part of me, and I just love community and I love getting to see people, was just that we were there together. It was very together. So it's kind of like each of us have our own favorite racing moment where we were, like, for me, it was when we watched American Pharoah at Keeneland with the Breeders' Cup, is that I don't think anyone in that stand, I mean, other than some betting interest, perhaps, were not cheering for that horse to win. It was that moment where everybody's together, feeling the togetherness of that energy. And that's what I loved. And I'm just kind of, sappy, but I loved that feeling on the apron, because there were only so many of us. Let's say there were like 30 of us watching any given race, but we all knew each other. That was sort of the strange thing. It was sort of like a private viewing, because it was, certainly all the grooms and hot walkers know each other, but the owners and the trainers, it just had this very intimate feel. Our media friends, they were all there, and it was as lovely as it could be. And I tried to enjoy it for everyone, like for everyone who wished they were there, it was still pretty magical. So I guess maybe that's my takeaway, is that even though it was a weird year, the actual thing that we still love is just as wonderful as it was despite nobody watching it.
It's a great message. It almost sounds to me like during the running of the race, it almost felt normal for a second. And then you sort of immediately snap back into the alternative reality. Just after. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
Yeah, I know it's a very good way to describe it, because I was very, very thankful for friends of ours, our mutual friends, like, you know, Mike McAdam and Seth Mara. I would text them whenever I had a horse in the paddock. I'd have all these pictures of me, you know, doing my job, which honestly, coming back to the job, is nothing. It's carrying the bucket or the bag until I get back to the barn when I actually do my real job, which is to walk the hot horse, which I love.
I need a picture. We'll put one of those pictures up for this blog post, please. Make a note to yourself to send me. Jim Lawson hopefully will not be offended by the fact that the other guest on the show gets the picture, but that sounds too cool to not throw up there. So I would appreciate that.
It would snap back, because I'd be sitting there watching a race with Seth or Mike and cheering and all that, and all of a sudden the race is over and I'm like, oh my God, I got to go. I'm like, enough with the chit chat. I got to go, like, carry my bag and, like, get out there with the hose and try to be useful and not in the way. You know, like, I just work here. Like, all of a sudden, I'm like, I was a fan for about literally 2 minutes. And now I'm like, I'm a working Joe and I got to get on it. So that was very funny. I'd have to switch gears, you know, radically.
Lightning fast, it sounds like. Yeah. Let's talk about your team for a minute. Who did you work for and with? And did you get to taste some success? And how did that change? How did that change the experience for you?
Yeah, well, I am very, very grateful for the trainer who gave me a shot as the rookie hot walker that I was. I'm no longer. I'm now a credentialed, you know, experienced hot walker. my trainer, my boss, was Amira Shashakli, who's a really talented and smart young woman who was Gary Contessa's assistant for quite a long time. She and I had crossed paths in the past, in that role. But now, as of Gary's retirement from the racing world, she has picked up and has the barn in her own hands. And I was just really, really grateful that she gave me this opportunity. So that was where I was. And again, it was really handy because she was in half of Linda Rice's traditional barn, which was this really nice location, great barn over on the harness track side of Nelson. And we had a super hardworking team that was incredibly kind to me. We had one exercise rider, we had two grooms, and then I was the second hot walker. So there's no better way to make yourself feel really important than to just be the second one. They're just, oh, thank God, there's one more person here. But Rena and I were the two hot walkers, and you know, we had quite a nice bond. And to your point, you know, we worked really hard. They worked really hard. There were about 14 horses there when I first arrived, which was a lot for that very dedicated team. But among those horses was one that I have to confess, I fell in love with her early. And I somewhat tried not to, probably for more reasons than I even wanted to acknowledge. But I just mostly was, you know, I had three rules. I think I told you this maybe early on, but the three goals for me in this whole experience were to not get hurt, to not lose a horse, and to not get fired. Every day, that was my mantra. so this little horse, her name was Bustin Scones. She was the one who cut right through my armor, such as it was, of not getting attached and just not getting hurt. And she has this name that folks will recognize with a name like that. Her daddy is indeed Bustin Stones. And she has this big white face that I guess he is really known for. This little horse is like a teeny little chestnut horse with a great big white face. So adorable. I have tons of pictures of her. And I fell in love with her because she was sweet as pie when I would walk her, which was a huge gift for me, because let's just to be clear, they weren't all like that. Especially not the cold ones. But she also, and there's probably something to be said for the fact that she's just wee. And so I felt like less intimidated by her. I could look over her. So she was, in that way, at least I had something on her, like slightly my height. Which isn't that much. But anyway, she and I totally bonded and I just loved her, loved her, loved her. But more importantly, to your question, she won. And that was such a thrill for everybody. So she won on that rainy, rainy day that was it the Forgo? I think it was the Forgo day. It was the last race of that Friday.
August 29th it was.
Okay. That sounds exactly right. And she, she did it. She's like this funny, wonderful little horse. I actually wrote about her in this little blog that I wrote, because she's so binary. She would be this, like, she was so present when we were walking with her ears flopping. And I think she liked walking. I think she just enjoyed walking. So she was very relaxed walking most of the time. And then when she'd get not only on the racetrack, actually the minute our rider, Robert, would get on her back, she turned into a fire breathing dragon. 100% just badass. I'm going to kill everyone and run as fast as I can in any direction, not necessarily straight. Like Robert said, she was such a handful to ride. And anyway, her win was certainly, to your point, a rallying moment for the whole barn. And especially for Amira, she had been working with this little horse since a long time ago, 2 years ago, I think they started. This little horse is 4 years old, right? So they would have started her when she was two, probably at Saratoga. And she's not easy, as Robert told me every time he'd come in the barn, and I'd look so happy to see her. And he never looked like all that happy because she was really, really a difficult horse to ride. And so just seeing that connection between Robert and Amira and this horse that they believed in despite her sort of quirkiness. And then even the jockey, if anybody wanted to watch the YouTube video of the Saratoga Live broadcast where Amira is interviewed, because that was her first Saratoga win. And like everyone knows that there's just legendarily nothing like your first win at Saratoga as a trainer. And just the pride in being a part of her team as she accomplished that was great. But she really credits the jockey because the jockey also stuck with this rather nutty little horse who didn't make it easy on anybody. So it was all really fun.
That must have been fantastic to get to, you know, especially at the end of the summer, to be able to get that moment. I mean, hey, it's obviously it's one thing for a trainer and a jockey and an owner to get their first Saratoga wins, but I would imagine in your role that felt like something special too, just to be part of the team.
Yeah, because I know, we all know, right, how hard they are to come by. I really felt amazed that I just got to sort of be around it. Everything, the whole experience, I felt like that. But, you know, even that morning, I did my special walk with Scones because she was a cold horse that morning. And that's the one cold horse I'm completely happy to walk. And she's just like trotting around on her toes. So we had a big talk and I told her to be very safe and to go very fast and that I would be trying to watch the race, which is like not this, like the thing I do the least well is actually watching the 2 minutes of the race. But I was in my living room with Bobby screaming and jumping and yelling, and especially because she did it fairly handily and she kind of galloped across the finish line with her ears flopping. And I thought, yes, you know, yay, it's my Scones.
That's great, great stuff. I wanted to ask you from a horse player's perspective. I know you have a bet from time to time, and of course, Bob Weir, very well-known contest player, member of the Buyer Speed Figure team, extremely involved on the wagering side. I was curious if there was anything you learned or any insight you could give horse players from spending the time that you did this summer on the backstretch.
Yeah, it's a good question. And certainly Bobby was quite keen to know if I was gathering any like useful intel from my turning left continually. So, you know, me and my like, well, I can tell you this one, like, you know, was really doesn't like the left corner where the grass is, you know, the one that's not so helpful. Like,
yeah, I don't know how we're going to put that into practical uses, yeah, horse players.
So I tried to think about it more meaningfully, especially for you, knowing you and I were going to chat. So, you know, it's not like I don't have that angle that, you know, Scott Coles is going to make his next NHC win on, but I am going to say that would one have the opportunity, so how's that for a lot of caveats, to hear the dialogue between the trainer and the rider, the exercise rider? I mean, this is the critical point. There are many, many critical points. It takes an entire village, and from the bath to the bandages being wrapped properly to the hot walker not losing the horse in the bad corner. You know, like there's a million things, like Barclay Tagg said, there's a million things can go wrong. And you need a million things to go right. But the thing that is the holy grail, I guess, if I were to say that at least I saw it, doesn't mean I have it to give to you and the listeners, but it is the communication between the exercise rider and the trainer, because that is where so much data is being conveyed. And I did find it, you know, interesting. I can't say that I, again, could bottle it to say what I was hearing Robert say to Amira. I mean, I can't, there's no secrets there other than they all must have their own way of communicating. And then there is such an importance to knowing how that horse felt. And I was in a barn that was sort of on a relatively modest size of horses compared to these like massive operations. So it just makes me wonder. It makes me think that is a piece of the puzzle. And I don't know how not very useful because I don't know how you tap into it. But that is where so much of the predictive intel is coming from. And I'm not saying, you know, go bribe exercise riders, but if you could listen in on that conversation, because I just think it just showed to me how every link is so important. But that link there is you know, and again, things you kind of technically know this, but to see it and to see that that intelligence on how that horse felt on that given day, on that given jog, you know, on that given breeze is just, there's something there. I don't know that it's anything anybody's going to put a bet in on Friday, but it is, that's a question if you ever get a chance to ask the trainer, because you're going to always ask the trainer, what did they think about their horse? But no. I guess my point is ask the trainer what their exercise rider says about the horse. Who knows?
Yeah. Where my brain goes when you talk about that is when you sometimes see trainers go in hot and cold streaks. And sometimes you investigate this and, you know, there are reductive explanations as to why a hot streak may happen, but there's often a lot of things to it that do get down to horsemanship. And, you know, maybe there is a new exercise rider or a new assistant trainer in the barn who's able to predict these things. And I've heard stories about trainers who were really good on turf for a number of years, and then they stopped being so good on turf. And I've investigated that and seen, oh, well, you know, there was this assistant. They had this assistant from Ireland who, you know, grew up on a farm and was so good with the turf horses. And then they left and then that skill goes with. So I think what I take away from it is just it just makes me want to be that much more sensitive when you're looking at fluctuations of trainer and barn form, just knowing that some unpublicized member of the team leaving or arriving can be the reason why those type of things happen in some instances. And it just goes to show that as horse players, we always want to be paying attention and trying to be in tune with what different stables are doing, because it can pay dividends. And I think your answer is giving us some of the why of that answer.
Mm. Well, thank you for finding a way to make it meaningful. Cause I think we all, it's so easy to think, oh, it's the trainer, just, you know, and the trainer is the CEO of the corporation that is that barn. And I've always loved that analogy, but you know, just like any corporation, the CEO is going to be the one who speaks to the media, who's going to be telling you what happens, but it's all those employees who are faceless and nameless. They are the critical pieces. And to me, the exercise rider was the wow, you know, and a lot of communication skills that are needed there, you know, and they're not all like verbal. So translating what a horse felt like to what you tell the trainer, like, boggles my mind as a horsewoman who is much more comfortable riding a horse than walking a horse. That was another big part of my lesson, was I don't know what to do with a horse when I'm just walking next to it. I can't control it nearly as well as I used to be able to when I was on it. But then to explain that to a trainer, and to do that when you're running full steam ahead, horse to horse to horse. So yeah, lots to be mulled on. And I'm hopeful that some of that is helpful.
We're running out of time here, but I have two more questions I have to ask you. The first one, I didn't prep you for this, and it might not be a fair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Yeah. You talked before about people telling you, oh, you have to see Saratoga in a normal year. Will you go back?
You know, I'm very open to going back. I think I will. I have to sort of, you know, yes, there are some, like, I have to make a different case because it theoretically isn't just my little personal growth experience anymore. Now what I want to do is, like, you know, go to the 201 level. That was my 101 year, you know, basically auditing the class where I had a very low bar, pass, fail, and I didn't, you know, get hurt, lose a horse, or get fired. So I passed. But there is something incredible. I just find the people, I mean, I think you and I both, that's why we gravitate to each other, is that this game is so interesting because it has these beautiful, magnificent animals at its heart. But then it's the people that those horses attract that keep us coming back because they're just so darn fascinating. So I cannot wait to do a comparison of the barn that I was at to just any other barn, because I know that some things would be true and a whole bunch of things would be different. So I'm super interested in doing it again. It'll be a matter of whether somebody wants, you know,
you've got a resume now.
Yeah. Well, I do have a resume. I think I'd like to be an afternoon specialist, if that's an opportunity out there for your airwaves, because once they've run a race, to your point, they're delightful to walk. And I get to see all my friends at the paddock.
That's great. Before I let you get out of here, we have to talk about the TRF Blackburn 2020 horse show. You've got a lot of special things planned. This is going to be happening on Tuesday, October 20th. So there's plenty of time for us to talk about it between now and then. But I know the event's just been launched, very, very different this year. And I want you to take a couple minutes to explain to the listeners what it's all about.
Well, thank you for letting me do that. And also in advance, thank you for letting me go deeper on this as we get closer, because it is a huge initiative. But what we're essentially doing is we're taking our program, the TRF Second Chances program, specifically at Blackburn Correctional Complex, which is in Lexington, Kentucky, right there in the heart of it all, right across the street from Keeneland, more or less. And we are opening the gates of the prison, presumably, to the world. No small task. We are going to show every set of eyes, every heart, and every mind that is open to seeing what we always talk about with these horses that are changing the lives of these men and women. We're going to show that live. We're going to go live streaming on October 20th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. It will be the TRF Blackburn 2020 Horse Show, and it will be a show of the men with the horses demonstrating their horse handling skills, the knowledge they've been learning in equine health and anatomy, conversation with the warden about what these men learned that enable them to leave and have successful lives post-incarceration. It's just going to be bottling the magic that is the TRF Second Chances program into essentially a 30-minute movie that we are live streaming on October 20th. So mark your calendar is the number one action item for every member of the In the Money Players Podcast audience. Please mark your calendar, October 20th, 8 p.m. You can be anywhere. As long as you have a phone and an internet connection, you can go to the horse show. And that's all we're looking for. You know, no small task. We want everyone to watch it and to see it and to experience it as best we can with a weird dose of gratitude for the crazy year we live in that made us figure this out.
That's right. This would be a good idea anyway. It's not easy to get people into a prison. So this is one of those weird things where the limitations of 2020 actually led to a creative idea that would be good no matter what year it is, the ability to see this program in action. I'm psyched about it. With your permission, Kim, would love to do a little viewing party potentially for In the Money listeners. Maybe we could set something up where we have a conversation beforehand, screen share on a Zoom, and a bunch of us get to watch and see you hosting this event and get to learn more about what this program is and to chat a little racing. You know, we'll be close to the Breeders' Cup then. Maybe we'll do sort of a little Q&A or something beforehand and then all watch the show together. I think it could be a lot of fun.
Oh my God. I love that. I love that idea. And I would be thrilled if you're you to do it. And that's precisely what we're hoping we can kind of create around the world. We have friends in Australia that we're encouraging to do the very same thing. I feel a little badly for all of your friends in Europe, because I know you've got all those Brits. It will be the middle of the night for them, but they can watch, they can participate. They can either stay up late or they can watch it the next day. Just know that it is something I think, will really make an impact, because I'm writing an email right before you and I talked about this is a mess. This is frankly as cheesy as you know I'm comfortable being. This is a message of hope in a world that needs some. And so please join us on October 20th. And I promise you'll feel more hopeful about the fate of the world. And that's
great. We can't do any better than that, Kim. We're gonna wrap right there on that message, which I don't think is cheesy at all. I think it's inspiring, and I thank you for the work that you do, not just on the backstretch in the mornings, but in the afternoons with the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. If folks want to give, Kim gave the info up top at trfinc.org/players. You can make your donations there, and if you donate $125 or more for a limited time, you can get a bottle of this In the Money Players Podcast whiskey as well. Kim, thank you so much for your time today.
What a pleasure, Pete. You be well and take care.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. I'd like to thank Jim Lawson and Kim Weir for participating in this show. Lots of great stuff from both of them. We'd like to thank our partners, including the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. You've heard plenty about them on the show, but also 10 Strike Racing, who've been there with us from the very beginning. Always like to root for their horses and enjoy speaking to both Marshall Graham and Clay Sanders and other members of the 10 Strike team. Most of all, I'd like to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. Be in touch, whether it's on Twitter, I'm at Looms Boldly, or over through the website, inthemoneypodcast.com, and the contact page there. We always appreciate constructive criticism, the questions you might want to send in, whatever it is, we're here for you to hopefully be a little bit of an extra horse racing community out there in the world and bring some people together. We've got some fun ways of doing that coming up. Stay tuned. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.
Just me.